Good morning again to a new class of students. Welcome. Our third case for argument this morning is United States versus Edlando Watson. Ms. Matheson. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Ellen Matheson. I'm here with my co-counsel, Eric Pearson, and we're representing the appellate today, Mr. Edlando Watson. Before diving into the details of Mr. Watson's case, I want to bring the first issue about the validity of the federal government's DNA collection into focus. There's a straightforward way to resolve this issue. It involves one, holding the government to its litigation strategy and decision to collect Mr. Watson's DNA under the independent source doctrine, and two, recognizing that the government did not meet its burden to show that the independent source doctrine applies. The DNA issue can and should be resolved like that. This court routinely holds the government to litigation decisions, precisely like the one made here.
Ms. Matheson, didn't the district court bring up the Maryland versus King argument, which the federal government then argued? And did the government waive an argument if the district court was the initial entity bringing it up?
Well, Your Honor, the government made a decision to litigate this under the independent source doctrine. In other words, it made a decision to choose one course and, you know, along the way explicitly said, we're not going to argue inevitable discovery and we're not going to argue good faith. We're not going to defend the validity of the warrants. And it said, we're not going to use this evidence. So I think that encompasses alternative rationales, including the incident to arrest line of thought, Maryland v. King, you know, even though the district court brought it up in sort of a dicta way, you know, sort of a, while we're at it, let me comment on this issue type of way. But it wasn't something that the government chose to do. And I think in this case, we have, you couldn't have a clearer example of the government deciding to choose a particular course. And the district court, even though it mentioned Maryland v. King, recognized that and said the government has said that it's not going to rely on this evidence explicitly. It said the government has agreed that it's not going to use the DNA swab that was collected by the state. So the government then collects the brand new DNA sample, but it does not at any point in this litigation satisfy its burden to show that the independent source doctrine actually applies. Even in the briefing on appeal, there is no explanation as to how the federal collection occurred independently of the states. Instead of trying to satisfy that burden, the government has spent a lot of time, as it did in the district court, in response to the second motion to suppress, trying to explain why the very evidence it agreed not to use should be considered valid after all. So on that first issue, this court should hold the government to its, you know, very intentional litigation decision and to its burden of proof on the independent source doctrine and reverse the denial of the suppression motions. And I will talk about the second issue, but I just want to note that I don't think it's necessary at this point to resolve the second issue. The court can reverse on the motions to suppress and send this back down for further proceedings in the district court. So the court should also reverse the denial of the motion to dismiss because, and again, I'm going to talk about burden. The government has presented no evidence showing that Mr. Watson's particular offenses fall within a recognized tradition of disarmament. It has not identified any class of persons at the founding who were considered dangerous for reasons comparable to those who possess cocaine or use marijuana in possession of a firearm. Even if we take for granted that dangerousness, for instance, can be an animating principle in these 922G cases, as it was in Rahimi, Section 922G1 contains no built-in judicial determination of a credible threat to physical safety, unlike 922G8, and unlike the surety and going armed laws. All we know is the fact of Mr. Watson's drug-related felony predicates. So one thing the government tries to do is to connect the dots between Mr. Watson and dangerousness is to go around the felony predicates entirely. It points to the fact that he was on bail and subject to a restraining order at the time of the G1 charge. And it also highlights the incident that occurred over 5 months before the weapons were found in Grand Chute, Wisconsin. None of that conduct, to be clear, is the basis for the G1 charge. For this proposition that the 922 G1 charge is the only permissible basis for assessing dangerousness, there's no better case than Rahimi. There, the Supreme Court, at the very beginning of the opinion, set forth shocking details about the defendant's alleged conduct. If you read the opinion, the court really leaves no stone unturned there. There's lots of detail. But when it came time to test and analyze the constitutionality of 922 G8 under the Bruin framework, the court did not rely on those facts at all. There's no mention of them. Instead, the court confined the analysis strictly to the statutory basis for the disarmament and examined whether the historical tradition supported a ban on firearm possession by a person who is subject to a restraining order. Here, the government asks this court to conflate Mr. Watson's predicate convictions with an assumption of inherent dangerousness. But unlike 922 G8, G1 doesn't have that built-in determination. Rahimi teaches that the proper constitutional analysis has to remain tethered to the statute, and here the mere existence of convictions for cocaine possession with intent to distribute and possessing a firearm while using marijuana don't satisfy that test.
Well, I'm not sure that's the right way to read Rahimi. The court wasn't really confronted with the kind of situation that we have here, which is an as-applied challenge. If the felon in possession statute is facially constitutional, then the next question is whether its application here to this defendant is an unconstitutional application under the Second Amendment. And there's it's really not entirely clear how we're supposed to analyze that, and whether it's limited to the statute of conviction that supports the felon in possession charge, or whether it's a broader look at whether this defendant who's requesting a Second Amendment exemption, essentially by way of a motion to dismiss a criminal charge under 922 G1, is sufficiently dangerous as to negate the claim for an exemption, either because dangerous people are outside the scope of the Second Amendment, or because there's a historical tradition from the framing of disarming dangerous people. So I think the methodology is still in flux, and I'm not sure we can, I mean, your interpretation of Rahimi is one way to read it, that it's pointing in a certain direction about the methodology, but I'm not sure it's the only way to read it.
I take your point about that, Your Honor, and the facial challenge versus the as-applied challenge. But what we know Rahimi did do was, you know, while it said we don't need to identify a historical twin, it did match up the why and the how of the historical analogs that it identified very closely to 922 G8. It said, what's the why? We're disarming people that present a credible threat. And how? Well, the surety and the going armed laws required that determination by a court of, you know, a judicial determination, and GA does the same thing. Here, the government hasn't done that. It's just sort of, it's waved at, you know, it's hand waved the dangerousness sort of concept. It said there's a historical tradition of disarming people who present a threat, people who are, you know, potentially violent, but it has not shown how G1 does the same work. G1 does not, by virtue of punishing all felons, and I'm not trying to suggest that I'm making a facial challenge here, but by virtue of punishing people like Mr. Watson, who have, you know, drug predicates, does not punish him for being violent or for being a critical threat. That's not what it's accomplishing. That's not its function.
Well, it does the same work. It just does so in a very broad fashion and disarms categorically all felons, whether their underlying conviction was violent or nonviolent or had some indicia of dangerousness. And again, we don't know as a matter of methodology how we're supposed to be assessing this, or at least it's an open question that the court has not given us a lot of instructions on yet.
Right.
So the 922 G1 is doing some of that work, but it's doing it in a very broad way, which is the whole as-applied argument.
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, it may be doing that work for some. The argument here is that it's not doing that for Mr. Watson, or at the very least that the government hasn't shown how the statute is doing that work for Mr. Watson. It points to again, conduct that shouldn't be considered relevant here, the bail and the domestic violence charges and the conduct that occurred 5 months prior to the charging. 922G1 doesn't sweep that broadly, and the government hasn't pointed to any conduct related to the underlying predicates outside of the fact of the predicate. So that's all we have here. And I don't know that we should say, just based on the fact that this person has predicate drug felonies, that he is dangerous and can be disarmed permanently without more. There has to be more evidence there. There has to be a better analog than sure.
Be evidence in a particular case or evidence that drug convictions have been viewed as very serious in the past. There are a whole bunch of federal statutes treating people with drug convictions as people who have serious violent felonies on their record.
That's right, Your Honor. I haven't seen those cases cited here. So I think the court, in order to do what the government wants it to do here and reject this as applied challenge, has to go outside of the record. It has to go outside of the briefing.
I'm referring to other federal statutes which raise the minimum sentence or require the removal of an alien who have been convicted of drug violations, right? The kind of cases that I initially thought you were relying on were like the Third Circuit's opinion in Range, where the prior conviction was for food stamp fraud 20 years ago. But drug convictions are generally viewed as an indication of a much more dangerous background than somebody who has a food stamp conviction. Isn't that something that Congress can think about?
Congress can think about that. I don't know that Congress has expressed that it thought about that here in G1. And I think to say, like to posit generally that drug crimes involve violence or involve violent people, something that is tempting to do.
Let me put the question a different way. Are you aware of any court of appeals that has held 922G1 invalid as applied to somebody with a conviction for distributing illegal drugs?
Your Honor, the other circuit case law is against my position. Yeah. I'm aware of that.
Uniformly against your position.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. But I think we need to dial back sort of this assumption that, and in this case, it's really about what evidence has been proffered in this case, right? Like not what evidence has been proffered in other circuits and other cases. Has the government here shown that the drug predicates on Mr. Watson's record render him a violent person? Those predicates, do they render him a violent person? And if we're going to, I think you have to make a leap, and there's not enough evidence to do that here.
The prosecutor's brief relies on 922G3 as well as G1. And I notice your reply brief doesn't discuss that. Do you have anything to say about 922G3?
He has a predicate conviction for, yes, possession of a gun while using marijuana, Your Honor, but I don't think that indicates that he's dangerous. And in fact, in Seward, this court rejected that very argument that a G3 conviction serves that historical justification of disarming dangerous persons.
Rather than an as-applied challenge, why not have Mr. Watson apply under 18 U.S.C. 925C and try to get his gun back that way?
Your Honor, that provision is not active right now.
It's on the books. It may not be funded, but apparently there's changes and there may be funding. So we've got a pending federal statute that allows for that. Doesn't that give him the route that he needs to get his gun back?
It does not for Mr. Watson.
Because he's dangerous or why?
Because it's too late.
It's too late. It's not available. He's in prison. This appeal will get resolved. That option won't be available to him. And I should reserve.
But I take it he never did apply under that statute.
Not that I'm aware of.
He just went ahead and possessed the gun.
Well, and there wasn't really a mechanism for him to do that, Your Honor. I should reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Endel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Josh Handel for the United States. Mr. Watson's conviction for unlawfully possessing firearms following a felony conviction.
Was he charged under 922 G3 as well as G1?
Your Honor, G3 was one of his predicate felonies. In this case, he was charged under G1.
Only under G1, so we don't need to consider G3.
That's correct.
I'm sure you know that a couple of federal circuits have now declared G3 unconstitutional on its face.
The
question is before the Supreme Court.
So Judge Easterbrook, I don't know if other circuits have declared it unconstitutional on its face,
Yes,
but they have
they
granted.
have. And
Okay.
the Solicitor General has asked the Supreme Court to review that, contending that they are wrong. At
I
least
absolutely
three
know.
circuits have declared G3 unconstitutional on its face.
So I know, for instance, that the Fifth Circuit has found constitutional defects in G3. I would point out, as we do in the brief, that the Fifth Circuit still upholds application of G1 to persons whose predicate felony convictions were entered under G3. I'm happy to keep talking about the Second Amendment issue, or switch back to the suppression claim.
On the Second Amendment issue, what prescribes, what stops a state government from prescribing speeding, for example, as a felony, and then resulting in subsequently disarming certain citizens? I'm trying to get to what are the bounds of legislative discretion with regard to the term felony to see where the government draws that line.
Sure. So I think something like you're positing, like just hyper felonization of, all of the state's laws as maybe a pretextual backdoor means of increasing gun control, that would be very ahistorical. And so I think that there would be a different, perhaps a different Second Amendment analysis applied to a law that, all of a sudden just boosted everything up to a year and a day sentencing range. I also think it's exceedingly unlikely that we would ever see anything like that because, I mean, doing that would mean that everyone would be entitled to a jury trial right under the Sixth Amendment. It would hold out the prospect that many people, many, speedsters, everyday kind of petty criminals would be subject to felony consequences totally independently of federal 922 G1, possible disenfranchisement, disqualification for certain employment, things like that. I think it's very unlikely that we would see that. I would also point out that, 922 G1 has been on the books since 1961. That's almost 70 years for states to have, taken this step and decided that they just really want to keep guns away from everybody. And so they're just going to jack everything up to a felony and felonize a whole, large swath of their population. And no state has done that. No state has done anything even close to that. So I understand the concern, but I don't think it's a hypothetical that's likely to come to pass. And I think in the event that it did come to pass, courts and potentially Congress would have avenues for dealing with that. I wanted to respond a little bit to the colloquy that Chief Judge Sykes, you were having with my friend about Rahimi. As I believe you pointed out, Rahimi was a facial decision. In fact, Mr. Rahimi expressly disclaimed any as-applied challenge, I think probably in light of the extremely egregious conduct that he had engaged in that case. And I would just point the court to Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinion in Rahimi, where he emphasizes that all that was decided that day was whether 922 G8 is facially valid. And he goes on to say, if we were deciding an as-applied challenge, we would take other things into account, including potentially whether the defendant had been acting in self-defense. Whether the defendant was acting in self-defense is not elementally relevant. It's not a fact that satisfies or dissatisfies any of the elements of a 922 G8 charge. It's just something else that he would take into account when he's doing the as-applied analysis. And I think that I like the statement by Judge Colleton in the Eighth Circuit case of United States versus Adams about this, which is essentially that when you're dealing with as-applied challenges, you have to show that the conduct to which the challenge statute is being applied was constitutionally protected. I think that makes total sense, right? The government carries its burden by showing that, by proving beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant committed every element of a statutory offense, and then a defendant mounting an as-applied challenge says, yes, I did. I did every one of these elements under the statute, but the Constitution interposes a barrier to applying the prescribed punishment to my proscribed conduct. And I think that that constitutional barrier has to be that the defendant was engaged in constitutionally protected conduct. And that is simply not even close to what we have here. I would also point the court, I know you're very familiar with United States versus Gay, which was also an as-applied challenge to 922G1 about the felon dispossession statute. And the court in Gay looked outside of the kind of the strict contours of the elements and the facts necessary to meet the elements and took into account, for instance, the fact that the defendant was on parole status at the time, the fact that the defendant had engaged in flight from the police and, you know, that created a danger. I think that, you know, those are the kinds of considerations that it is appropriate to take into account when you are evaluating an as-applied challenge.
What about Atkinson, though? Atkinson takes the route of it follows the idea that we've got to do that deep historical tradition, that analysis. Is that reconcilable?
So I think a couple of things about Atkinson. First, you know, that was a very early post-Bruin case. And one of the one way that I read Atkinson is saying, you know, we can't rely on the Supreme Court's statements about the presumptive validity of felon dispossession statutes because Bruin was number one, a methodological sea change. And number two, more importantly, the court's opinion in Bruin did not repeat that formulation that had been present in the opinions in Heller and McDonald. But then Rahimi came, and Rahimi postdated Atkinson. And once again, the court confirmed the presumptive validity of felon dispossession statutes in the opinion for the court. And the court, you know, also told us that some lower courts had been applying Bruin too tightly, that they had been searching for historical twins rather than historical principles. And the court said, we're not supposed to do that. We're not, you know, looking for a law trapped in amber. We are looking at the historical record in order to derive principles that inform modern statutes and inform specifically the meaning of the Second Amendment as applied to modern
But
statutes.
even reading that dicta, for all that it's worth, about the presumptive validity of 922G1 felon in possession statutes and state corollaries to it, leaves open the possibility of as applied challenges. And there's some uncertainty as a matter of methodology about how we're supposed to go about that. And so, you know, what's the government's best case or position on the appropriate methodology for as applied challenges? Because Supreme Court really hasn't spoken to that yet.
Sure.
And
So, you know, I think two relatively recent decisions of this court helped to inform our view. I already mentioned United States versus Gay, where, you know, it took into account the defendant's non-elemental facts of the defendant's parole status, his parole conditions, looked at the circumstances of his interdiction. I would also point to the very recent decision in Siewert. Which was a G3 case, so it's, you know, maybe a little bit off point, but it was an as-applied challenge. The court only reached the re only discussed the as-applied challenge and then determined that because the statute was constitutional as applied to that defendant, it could not be facially unconstitutional. But in conducting the as-applied challenge, the court again went beyond just the bare facts minimally necessary to meet the statutory elements. And it looked to things like how recently Mr. Seward had engaged in his drug use, the fact that he was actually intoxicated at the time that he possessed a firearm. Those are not things that we have to prove up in order to get a G3 conviction, but they were relevant to the as-applied challenge. And so again, you know, we think I would back up a little bit and say the government's position is that 922G1 is constitutional in all its applications. And we would love it if you wrote an opinion saying that and saying that there is no possibility of as-applied challenges. That is the kind of emerging consensus position among courts of appeals, as we pointed out in our 28J letters discussing the en banc Ninth Circuit's decision and the recent decision by the Second Circuit.
Right, but the
Contra, Fifth Circuit, Third Circuit, Sixth Circuit. Where's a consensus there?
Majority was maybe a better one.
Hey. Who's counting?
No, fair enough, Judge Easterbrook. But you know, we think it is that a categorical felon prohibition is consistent with history and tradition. It is consistent with the principle that legislatures can disarm persons convicted of serious crimes. It is consistent with the related principle that legislatures can make sensible, predictive judgments about persons who they believe represent a heightened danger of misusing firearms, and that they can engage in that analysis on a categorical level. But certainly, you know, if the inclination is just to resolve the as-applied challenge here, I think we have offered a number of aspects, circumstances of this conduct that easily demonstrate that Mr. Watson was not engaged in constitutionally protected activity. He was, as has been pointed out, he was on bail. He was subject to a domestic violence protective order issued by a court based on individualized findings. He his previous convictions involved drug trafficking and a prior firearm conviction, which are the kinds of things that demonstrate, you know, if not a proclivity to violence, at least a heightened danger that firearms will be misused in the future.
We have a Fourth Amendment issue here, too. So maybe
thank you.
A little attention to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, we think there are four independent reasons why the suppression claim should fail. The state warrants were valid. They were relied on in good faith. It was independently permissible to take Mr. Watson's DNA as a search incident to his lawful arrest, and the federal collection was independent of any defects in the state investigation. I do want to say, I think there's a danger in this case, and it's probably due to our briefing, of missing the forest for the trees here. You know, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. Suppression, the exclusionary rule, are extraordinarily disfavored because suppressing evidence comes at a steep cost to the truth-seeking function of the trial. And so the Supreme Court has told us this should not be your method of first resort. You should only suppress evidence when there's significant deterrent value here. And I don't know that any court in any case ever has found that there would be significant deterrent value where the police went out and got three warrants for this evidence, three warrants that all said, we can collect Mr. Watson's DNA. You know, we can talk about the timeline and we can fly spec certain language in the warrants and things like that. But this is just not a case where police were cutting corners or where there would be any significant deterrent value to vacating Mr. Watson's.
If we focus only on the federal warrant, we do have an argument that any arguments about the state warrants were waived here. And let's just, for the sake of argument, say that we set those aside. What about the validity of the federal warrant standing alone on an independent foundation?
Sure. So, you know, there's been no contention that anyone in the federal government engaged in any misconduct here, or that there are, you know, any defects in the federal warrant. They all relate back. It's a taint issue. You know, I think there's no dispute that the federal warrant was independent here of the state collection, because the affidavit supporting the federal warrant outlined abundant evidence implicating Mr. Watson in the shooting, none of which related back to any of the evidence obtained under the state warrants. The district court also found that it was inevitable. This is at appendix pages 48 and 49. And Mr. Watson has not shown that finding to be clearly erroneous. I just want to, sorry, I see that I'm out of time. If I can just finish this very quickly. The district court said, had Watson's DNA not already been available in the state case, the federal government certainly would have obtained it in its investigation of the charges here. Again, I don't think that's clearly erroneous, but we think that you should uphold on the validity of the state warrants or any of the other grounds that we've forwarded on that issue. Unless the court has further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Matheson.
You know, with respect to my friend, Your Honors, he still has not said anything about why the federal warrant is independent of the state collection, which is the grounds that we are pressing on appeal for reversal of the motions to suppress. I do also want to clarify just one thing factually. We didn't turn this into a fulsome argument on appeal because it wasn't an argument in the district court, but the federal warrant does reference the state DNA collection in paragraphs 12 and 14. I just want that to be clear. Of course, the Fourth Amendment is based in, you know,
it
reasonableness.
It doesn't mention the match.
I think it
mentions the DNA collection.
Paragraph 14, I believe it does mention the match, Your Honor. Determine the presence of male DNA on 10 swabs.
Not a match to the subject here.
But, that's fair. Yes, right. You're right. We did make an argument of that, and I'm wrong about that. But the Fourth Amendment, while grounded in reasonableness principles, cannot entirely overtake the doctrine of waiver, or we might as well not have one. And with that, Mr. Watson requests reversal of the denial of the motions to suppress and the motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.